Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Over the last several months, I have been investigating into the whole issue of what is known as the web of debt. We have been using a book called The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown, who's an attorney, to try to understand what is really perceived as the shocking truth about our money system, and of course, ultimately, how we can break free. In short, our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. The Web of Debt is a book that unravels this deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. It then, in a positive vein, explores workable alternatives, one in particular that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It's a very important and ultimately practical presentation of what money is all about, and of course then how to deal with it for our own financial security, for that of the nation, and ultimately the entire globe. At the onset, I'd like to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 other books and scores of articles in the area of debt. I highly recommend that you actually read her book, The Web of Debt. You can also go to her website by the same name, and you can review all of the shows that we have produced for debt-related issues at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, and specifically on this topic, Life and Debt Web. Now we'll review a little bit what we did in the last show, which is Harnessing the Lion, the Federal Income Tax. In the Web of Debt, there is a parallel that is outlined between The Wizard of Oz, specifically the book, which was written to point out the economic trials in an allegorical way for farmers and industrial workers coming into the 20th century. Regarding federal income tax, there's a quote, "With Dorothy hard at work, the witch thought she would go into the courtyard and harness the cowardly lion like a horse. It would amuse her, she was sure, to make him draw her chariot whenever she wished to go to drive. If the cowardly lion represented the people unaware of their power, the harness that would hitch the lion to the chariot of the bankers was the federal income tax. Slipping the harness over the lion's mane was no mean feat. The American people had chafed at the burden of taxes ever since King George III had imposed them on the colonies. The colonists had been taxed for all sorts of consumer goods, from tea to tobacco to legal documents. Taxation without representation led to the revolt of the Boston Tea Party, in which the colonists dumped tea into the Boston Harbor in protest against a tax imposed by Parliament on tea in the colonies. So, in designing the Constitution for their new utopia, our founding fathers left the federal income tax out. They considered the taxation of private income, the ultimate source of productivity, to be economic folly. To avoid excess taxation, they decided at the Federalist debates that the states and the new federal government could not impose the same kind of tax at the same time. For example, if the states imposed a property tax, the federal government could not impose one. Congress would be responsible for collecting national taxes from the states, which would collect taxes from their citizens. Direct taxes were to be apportioned according to the population of each state. Income taxes were considered unapportioned direct taxes in violation of this provision of the Constitution. That is an important concept. The income taxes were considered unapportioned direct taxes. The absence of an income tax had actually allowed the economy to grow and its citizens to prosper for over a century. From 1776 to 1913, except for brief periods when the country was at war, the federal government had been successfully funded mainly with customs and excise taxes. In 1812, to fund the War of 1812, the first sales tax was imposed on gold, silverware, jewelry, and watches. The first income tax was also imposed that year, but in order to comply with constitutional requirements, it was apportioned among the states, which collected the tax from property owners. In 1817, when the war was over, the new taxes were terminated. The first national income tax, as we know it, was imposed in 1862. Again, it was to support a war effort, the war between the states. The tax was set at a mere 1-3% of income, and it applied only to those having annual incomes over $800, a category that then included less than 1% of the population. Congress avoided constitutional apportionment requirements by classifying the new tax as an indirect tax. It was, in fact, a misapplication of the law, but the tax was not challenged until 1871. The delay allowed a precedent to be established by which Congress could bypass constitutional restrictions by incorrectly classifying the taxes. In 1872, this tax, too, was repealed. Another income tax was passed in 1894, but no war was in progress to win sympathy for it, and it was immediately struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1895, in a very important case, Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust Company, the Supreme Court held that general income taxes violate the constitutional guideline that taxes levied directly on the people are to be levied in proportion to the population of each state. That ruling has never been overruled. Instead, the Wall Street faction decided to make an end run around the Constitution. In 1913, the 16th Amendment was introduced to Congress as a package deal along with the Federal Reserve Act. Both were supported by the Wall Street Senator Nelson Aldrich. The amendment provided, "Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration." That's the 16th Amendment. Wealthy businessmen who had opposed the federal income tax were easily won over when they learned they could avoid paying the tax themselves by setting up tax-free foundations. The taxes affected only incomes over $4,000 a year, a sum that was then well beyond the wages of most Americans. The amendment was simply worded, the tax return was only one page long, and the entire tax code was only 14 pages long. It seemed harmless enough at the time. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Well, now we had the federal income tax. So the 16th Amendment allowed direct taxation of the people. And even though it seemed very simple and harmless for most people at the time, 1913, from that 14-page long tax code, we now have a 17,000-page sieve of obscure legalese, providing enormous loopholes for those who can afford the lobbyists to negotiate them. Corporations with enough clout, such as Enron had, were able to get whole pages devoted to their private interests. Enron paid no taxes for 4 of the 5 years from 1996 through 2000, although it was profitable during those years. The tax system has become so complex that tens of millions of taxpayers have to seek professional help to comply with its mandates. That's no surprise to most of us. By 1995, at least $250 billion were paid annually for these services, in addition to the $8 billion required to operate the Internal Revenue Service itself. The IRS has 144,000 employees, more than all but the 36 largest U.S. corporations, and it employed more investigators than the FBI and the CIA combined. More than 5 billion hours were spent annually in the effort to comply with federal income tax requirements, close to the total number of hours worked yearly by all the people in all jobs in the state of Indiana. The obscure court holdings testing the tax code's constitutionality can be as impenetrable as the code itself. Take, for example, the convoluted single sentence in a tax case titled Brushhaber versus Union Pacific Railroad. This is a 1916 case, and this is a single sentence. Quote, "The contention that the amendment treats a tax on income as a direct tax, although it is relieved from apportionment and is necessarily therefore not subject to the rule of uniformity as such, rule only applies to taxes which are not direct, thus destroying the two great classifications which have been recognized and enforced from the beginning, is a wholly without foundation, since the command of the amendment that all income taxes shall not be subject to apportionment by a consideration of the sources from which the taxed income may be derived, forbids the application to such taxes of the rule applied in the Pollock case, by which alone such taxes were removed from the great class of excises, duties, and imposts subject to the rule of uniformity and were placed under the other or direct class." That's a single sentence in a tax case. Now, I'm a lawyer and I have no clue what that means. And while this case was not easy to decipher, it has been construed as holding that the 16th Amendment does not overrule Pollock in declaring general income taxes unconstitutional, and that the amendment does not amend the U.S. Constitution on the question of income taxes. Rather, said the court, the 16th Amendment applies to excise taxes. It merely clarifies the federal government's existing authority to create excise taxes without apportionment, and it applies only to gains and profits from commercial and investment activities. Well, these fine points were of little interest to most people before World War II, since few people were actually affected by the tax. But war again provided the pretext for expanding the law's scope. In 1939, Congress passed the public salary tax, taxing the wages of federal employees. In 1940, it passed the Buck Act, authorizing the federal government to tax federal workers living outside Washington, D.C. In 1942, Congress passed the Victory Tax under its constitutional authority to support the country's war efforts. A voluntary tax withholding program was proposed by President Roosevelt, which allowed workers to pay the tax in installments. This program was so successful that the number of taxpayers increased from 3% to 62% of the U.S. population. In 1944, the Victory Tax and voluntary withholding laws were repealed as required by the U.S. Constitution, but the federal government, without raising the matter before the court or the voters, continued to collect the income tax, pointing for authority to the 16th Amendment. Today, the federal income tax has acquired the standing of a legitimate tax enforceable by law, despite long-standing rulings by the Supreme Court strictly limiting its constitutional scope. Other taxes have also been added to the list, which currently includes an accounts receivable tax, building permit tax, capital gains tax, CDL license tax, cigarette tax, corporate income tax, federal unemployment tax, food license tax, fuel permit tax, gasoline tax, inheritance tax, inventory tax, IRS interest charges, IRS penalties, liquor tax, luxury taxes, marriage license tax, Medicare tax, property tax, real estate tax, service charge taxes, road usage taxes for truckers, road and toll bridge taxes, sales tax, school tax, Social Security tax, state unemployment tax, telephone taxes and surcharges, trailer registration taxes, utility taxes, vehicle license registration taxes, vehicle sales tax, and workers' compensation tax, among others. Estimates are that when the hidden taxes paid by the workers all the way up the chain of production are factored in, over 40% of the average citizen's income may be going to taxes. Now, there's also another issue with the 16th Amendment. Was it properly ratified? A variety of challenges to the tax code have been prompted by inequities in the system. In 1984, a tax protester named Bill Benson spent a year visiting state capitals researching whether the 16th Amendment was properly ratified by the states in 1913. He found that of the 38 states allegedly ratifying it, 33 had amended the language to say something other than what was passed, a power states do not possess. He argued that the amendment was properly ratified by only two states. He attempted unsuccessfully to defend a suit for tax evasion on that ground and spent some time in jail, but that did not deter later tax protesters from raising the defense. In 1989, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals again rejected the argument, not because the court disagreed with the data, but because it concluded that when the Secretary of State, Philander Knox, declared the amendment adopted in 1913, he had taken the defects into consideration. Knox's decision, said the Seventh Circuit, is now beyond review. Well, now we go a full circle. Who is this Philander Knox? It comes as no great surprise that Philander Knox was the robber baron's man behind the scenes. He was an attorney who became a multimillionaire as counsel to multimillionaires. And I'll get back in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now back to Philander Knox, multimillionaire lawyer as legal counsel to multimillionaires. He saved Andrew Carnegie from prosecution and civil suit in 1894 when it was shown that Carnegie had defrauded the Navy with inferior armor plate for U.S. warships. Knox saved Carnegie again when the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad testified that Carnegie had regularly received illegal kickbacks from the railroad. Knox also saved his college friend William McKinley from financial ruin before McKinley won the 1896 presidential race. In 1899, President McKinley offered Knox the post of U.S. Attorney General, but Knox declined. He was then too busy arranging the largest conglomerate in history, the merger of the railroad, oil, coal, iron, and steel interests of Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, and other robber barons into U.S. Steel. After completing the U.S. Steel merger, Knox accepted McKinley's offer over vigorous opposition. The appointment put him in charge of prosecuting the antitrust laws against the very same robber barons he had built a career and a professional fortune representing. When the U.S. Steel merger met with public outcry, Knox said he knew nothing and could do nothing, and U.S. Steel emerged unscathed. When McKinley was assassinated in 1901, Knox continued as Attorney General under Teddy Roosevelt, drafting federal statutes that gave his wealthy and powerful friends even more power and control over interstate commerce. Agents of the conglomerates wound up sitting on government boards and commissions that set rates and eliminated competition in restraint of trade. Knox was appointed Secretary of State by President Taft in 1909 when Senator Aldridge gave the 16th Amendment a decisive push through Congress. The amendment was rushed through right before Knox resigned as Secretary of State. That may explain why he was willing to overlook a few irregularities. If he had left the matter to a successor, there was no telling the outcome. In short, we'll never really see or understand the maneuverings behind creating the federal tax system and how those manipulations were probably filled with all kinds of irregularities, possible illegalities, and certainly favoritism to the wealthy. But it leads to the question, do we need a federal income tax? In upholding these irregularities against constitutional challenge, courts may have been motivated by a perceived need to preserve a federal income tax that has come to be considered indispensable to funding the government. But our question is it really? A report issued by the Grace Commission during the Reagan administration concluded that most federal income tax revenues go just to pay the interest on the government's burgeoning debt. Indeed, that was the purpose for which the tax was originally designed. When the federal income tax was instituted in 1913, all income tax collections were forwarded directly to the Federal Reserve. Again, Federal Reserve, private business owned by the major private commercial banks in America and highly influenced behind the scenes by international financiers. In the fiscal year 2005, the U.S. government spent $352 billion just to service the government's debt. The sum represented more than one-third of individual income tax revenues that year, which totaled $927 billion. As for the other two-thirds of the individual income tax tab, the Grace Commission concluded that those payments did not go to service necessary government operations either. A cover letter addressed to President Reagan stated that a third of all income taxes were consumed by waste and inefficiency in the federal government. Another third of any taxes actually paid went to make up for the taxes not paid by tax evaders and the burgeoning underground economy, a phenomenon that had blossomed in direct proportion to tax increases. The report concluded, quote, "With two-thirds of everyone's personal income taxes wasted or not collected, 100% of what is collected is absorbed solely by interest on the federal debt and by federal government contributions to transfer payments." In other words, all individual income tax revenues are gone before one nickel is spent on the services which taxpayers expect from their government. End of quote. Now that's a frightening thought. None of our income tax money is actually being used by the government to service the U.S. citizens. But for our purposes, even the third going for interest on the federal debt could have been avoided if Congress had created the money itself on the Franklin-Lincoln model we have discussed in the past. But the obscurely worded Federal Reserve Act delegated the power to create money to a private banking monopoly, and Congress, like the sleeping public, had been deceived by the banker's sleight of hand. The head had thundered and the walls had shook. The wizard's wizardry had worked, at least on the mesmerized majority. Among the few who remained awake was Representative Charles Lindbergh Sr., who warned on the day the Federal Reserve Act was passed, quote, "This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this bill, the invisible government by the monetary power will be legalized. The people may not know it immediately, but the day of reckoning is only a few years removed. End of quote. The day of reckoning came just 16 years later. And that's the day of reaping the whirlwind, which is, of course, the Great Depression. So back to the Wizard of Oz. Uncle Henry sat upon the doorstep and looked anxiously at the sky, which was even grayer than usual. From the far north, they heard a low wail of the wind, and Uncle Henry and Dorothy could see where the long grass bowed in waves from the coming storm. The stock market crashed in 1929, precipitating a worldwide depression that lasted a decade. Few people remember it today, but we can still get the flavor in the movies. The Great Depression was depicted in the barren black and white Kansas drought opening the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz. It was also the setting for It's a Wonderful Life, a classic 1946 film shown on TV every Christmas. The film starred Jimmy Stewart as a beloved small-town banker named George Bailey, who was driven to consider suicide after a run on his bank when the townspeople all demanded their money and he couldn't pay. The promise of the Federal Reserve Act that it would prevent bank panics by allowing a conglomeration of big banks to come to the rescue of little banks that got caught short-handed had obviously failed. The crash of 1929 was the biggest bank run in history. The problem began in the Roaring Twenties when the Fed made money plentiful by keeping interest rates low. Money seemed to be plentiful, but what was actually flowing freely was credit or debt. Production was up more than wages were up, so more goods were available than money to pay for them, but people could borrow. By the end of the 1920s, major consumer purchases such as cars and radios, which were then large pieces of furniture that sat on the floor, were bought mainly on credit. Money was so easy to get that people were borrowing just to invest, taking out short-term, low-interest loans that were readily available from the banks. The stock market held little interest for most people until the robber barons started promoting it after amassing large stock holdings very cheaply themselves. They sold the public on the idea that it was possible to get rich quick by buying stock on margin or on credit. The investor could put a down payment on the stock and pay off the balance after its price went up, reaping a hefty profit. This investment strategy turned the stock market into a speculative pyramid scheme in which most of the money invested did not actually exist. People would open margin accounts not because they could afford to pay 100% of the stock price, but because it allowed them to leverage their investments, buying 10 times as much stock by paying only a 10% down payment. And leveraging means buying securities with borrowed money. The public went wild over this scheme. In a speculative fever, many people literally bet the farm. They were taking out loans against everything they owned, homes, farms, life insurance, anything to get the money to get into the market and make more money. Homesteads that had been owned free and clear were mortgaged to the bankers, who fanned the fever by offering favorable credit terms and interest rates. The Federal Reserve made these favorable terms possible by substantially lowering the rediscount rate, the interest rate member banks paid to borrow from the Fed. The Fed thus made it easy for the banks to acquire additional reserves, against which they could expand the money supply by many multiples with loans. And we will continue on this journey during the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.